This is not to say, stupidly, that all motivational states, or all facts, or all behavioral possibilities are equally beneficial in all situations. It is rather that our acts of self-definition, many of which have an arbitrary cultural grounding, determine what we are willing to accept at any given place and moment as good and as evil. The self-sacrificing domestic martyr, for example, who accepts her husband's every authoritarian demand. She has defined her capacity for violence as ethically unsuitable and will regard it as something forbidden and evil. This makes aggression something contaminated by the dragon of chaos from the martyr's perspective. She will therefore remain a miserable doormat unless she learns to bite, which means until she drops her present all-too-restrictive, easygoing, and affectionate stance, which is not doing her husband any good either by reinforcing his weak fascistic tendencies, nor improving the society of which her marriage is a part. Her inability to be angry, which is in reality her inability to regard herself as possessed of intrinsic worth, removes necessary limitations to her husband's inappropriate and socially dangerous expansion of power. It is thus the unsuitable desire that is often precisely what is necessary to lift us beyond our present uncomfortable stasis. This does not mean simple-minded application of a poorly designed strategy of previously repressed, motivated behavior. It means, instead, true integration of what has not yet been expressed or even admitted into the structure of harmonious intrapsychic and social relations. Ye have heard that it hath been said, Thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy. But I say unto you, Love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you, that ye may be the children of your Father which is in heaven. For he maketh his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sendeth rain on the just and on the unjust. For if ye love them which love you, what reward have ye? Do not even the publicans the same? And if ye salute your brethren only, what do ye more than others? Do not even the publicans so? Be ye therefore perfect, even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect. Matthew 5:43-48. The adoption of a particular socially determined conceptualization of the way allows for provisional establishment of the meaning of experiences, objects, situations, and processes. The nature of the goal toward which action and ideation is devoted in the ideal determines what behaviors and products of imagination and abstract thought come to be regarded as acceptable and are therefore developed, and which are forbidden and are therefore left repressed and stunted. If the individual or social ideal remains undeveloped, immature in conceptualization, or twisted in the course of development, then aspects of behavior and cognition necessary for redemption, for deliverance from the unbearable weight of tragic self-consciousness, will be suppressed, with intrapsychic and social pathology as the inevitable result. If the individual strives primarily for material security or social acceptance rather than for the mythic love of God and fellow man, then respect for truth will suffer and complete adaptation will become impossible. And when he was gone forth into the way, there came one running and kneeled to him and asked him, Good master, what shall I do that I may inherit eternal life? And Jesus said unto him, Why callest thou me good? There is none good but one, that is, God. Thou knowest the commandments. Do not commit adultery. Do not kill. Do not steal. Do not bear false witness. Defraud not. Honor thy father and mother. And he answered and said unto him, Master, all these have I observed from my youth. Then Jesus, beholding him, loved him, and said unto him, One thing thou lackest. go thy way, sell whatsoever thou hast, and give to the poor, and thou shalt have treasure in heaven, and come, take up the cross, and follow me. And he was sad at that saying, and went away grieved, for he had great possessions. And Jesus looked round about, and saith unto his disciples, how hardly shall they that have riches enter into the kingdom of God? And the disciples were astonished at his words. But Jesus answereth again, and saith unto them, children, how hard is it for them that trust in riches to enter into the kingdom of God? It is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter into the kingdom of God. And they were astonished out of measure, saying among themselves, who then can be saved? Mark 10:17-26. The highest value toward which effort is devoted determines what will become elevated and what subjugated in the course of individual and social existence. If security or power is valued above all else, then all will become subject to the philosophy of expedience. In the long term, adoption of such a policy leads to development of rigid, weak personality or social environment, or intrapsychic dissociation and social chaos. Jesus said, a man had received visitors, and when he had prepared the dinner, he sent his servant to invite the guest. He went to the first one and said to him, my master invites you. He said, I have some claims against some merchants. They are coming to me this evening. I must go and give them my orders. I ask to be excused from the dinner. He went to another and said to him, my master has invited you. He said to him, I have just bought a house and am required for the day. I shall not have any spare time. He sent to another and said to him, my master invites you. He said to him, my friend is going to get married, and I am to prepare the banquet. I shall not be able to come. I ask to be excused from the dinner. He went to another and said to him, my master invites you. He said to him, I have just bought a farm, and I am on my way to collect the rent. I shall not be able to come. I ask to be excused. The servant returned and said to his master, those whom you invited to the dinner have asked to be excused. The master said to his servants, go outside to the streets and bring back those whom you happen to meet so that they may dine. Businessmen and merchants will not enter the places of my Father. The Gospel of Thomas. A man who has put his faith in what he owns rather than what he stands for will be unable to sacrifice what he owns for what he is. He will necessarily choose, when the reemergence of uncertainty forces choice, what he has gathered around him instead of what he could be. This decision will weaken his nature and make him unable to cope with the tragic weight of his consciousness. It will turn him toward the lie and make him an active agent in production of his own and his society's insufficiency. If the goal toward which behavior is devoted remains pathologically restricted, if the highest ideal remains, for example, sensual pleasure, social acceptance, power, or material security, then aspects of behavior and ideation which exist in opposition to these goals will become pathologically twisted in orientation because forced to serve a contemptible master, will be defined as evil, left undeveloped in consequence, and remain unavailable for use in more potentially inclusive redemptive activity, will become subjugated, suppressed, and stagnant. This lack of development and associated sickening will decrease adaptive flexibility in the face of the true challenges of life, will ensure that life's challenges appear devastating. The myth of the way, which describes human experience itself, encompasses loss of paradise, emergence of tragedy, and then redemption. And it is the fool, the true individual, who is in desperate need of redemption. To identify with the group is to deny the fool and to therefore lose all hope. Then shall they also answer him, saying, Lord, when saw I thee and hungered or athirst, or a stranger, or naked, or sick, or in prison, and did not minister unto thee? Then shall he answer them, saying, Verily I say unto you, inasmuch as ye did it not to one of the least of these, ye did it not to me. Matthew 25:44-45. We have a model of ourselves in imagination and semantic representation which is in ill accord with the actuality of ourselves in procedure, imaginative capacity, and potential for thought. This lack of isomorphism, this willful lack of attention to truth, means that behavior and potential thereof exist, which is anomalous with regard to the ideal of behavior in representation. I couldn't do that. That episodic capacity and content exist, which is anomalous to the ideal of such capability and content in representation. I couldn't imagine that. And that semantic ability and content exists, which is anomalous with regard to the ideal of semantic ability and content in representation. I couldn't think that. Pathological use of this model, the replacement of actuality with an insufficient idea conceptualized in fantasy, restricts adaptation to the unexpected, to change itself. This means existence in boundless and ever-expanding misery. Which way I fly is hell, myself am hell, and in the lowest deep, a lower deep still threatening to devour me opens wide, to which the hell I suffer seems a heaven. Milton, Paradise Lost. The devil, traditional representation of evil, refuses recognition of imperfection, refuses to admit, I was in error, in my action, in my representation, accepts as a consequence of unbending pride, eternal misery, refuses metanoia, confession and reconciliation, remains forever the spirit that refuses and rejects. Oh, then at last relent. Is there no place left for repentance, none for pardon left? None left but by submission. And that word disdain forbids me, and my dread of shame among the spirits beneath, whom I seduced with other promises and other vaunts than to submit, boasting I could subdue the omnipotent. Ay me, they little know how dearly I abide that boast so vain, under what torments inwardly I groan, while they adore me on the throne of hell, with diadem and scepter high advanced. The lower still I fall, only supreme in misery. Such joy ambition finds. But say, I could repent, and could obtain, by act of grace, my former state. How soon should height recall high thoughts? How soon unsay what feigned submission swore? Ease would recant vows made in pain as violent and void. For never can true reconcilement grow where wounds of deadly hate have pierced so deep, which would but lead me to a worse relapse and heavier fall. So should I purchase dear short intermission, bought with double smart. This knows my punisher. Therefore, as far from granting he, as I from begging, peace. All hope excluded thus. Milton, Paradise Lost. Such refusal, the inability to say, I was wrong, I am sorry, I should change, means the death of hope, existence in the abyss. Rejection of fact means alienation from God, from meaning, from truth, and life without meaning is suffering without recourse, worthy of nothing but destruction, in accordance with self-definition. Northrop Frye states, The way of life is described as beginning in metanoia, a word translated repentance by the Authorized Version, which suggests a moralized inhibition of the stop doing everything you want to do variety. What the word primarily means, however, is change of outlook or spiritual metamorphosis, an enlarged vision of the dimensions of human life. Such a vision, among other things, detaches one from one's primary community and attaches him to another. When John the Baptist says, "Bring forth fruits worthy of metanoia," Matthew 3:8, he is addressing Jews, and goes on to say that their primary social identity, descent from Abraham, is of no spiritual importance. The dialectic of metanoia and sin splits the world into the kingdom of genuine identity, presented as Jesus' home, and a hell, a conception found in the Old Testament only in the form of death or the grave. Hell is that, but it is also the world of anguish and torment that man goes on making for himself all through history. The act of metanoia is adaptation itself, admission of error, founded on faith in ability to tolerate such admission and its consequences. Consequential dissolution, subjugation to the hateful siege of contraries, and, Deo concedente, restoration of intrapsychic and interpersonal integrity. As Solzhenitsyn comments, "As soon as you have renounced that aim of surviving at any price, and gone where the calm and simple people go, then imprisonment begins to transform your former character in an astonishing way, to transform it in a direction most unexpected to you." And it would seem that in this situation, feelings of malice, the disturbance of being oppressed, aimless hate, irritability, and nervousness ought to multiply. But you yourself do not notice how, with the impalpable flow of time, slavery nurtures in you the shoots of contradictory feelings. Once upon a time, you were sharply intolerant. You were constantly in a rush, and you were constantly short of time. And now you have time with interest. You are surfeited with its months and years, behind you and ahead of you, and a beneficial calming fluid pours through your blood vessels. Patience. You are ascending. Formerly, you never forgave anyone. You judged people without mercy, and you praised people with equal lack of moderation. And now, an understanding mildness has become the basis of your uncategorical judgments. You have come to realize your own weakness, and you can therefore understand the weakness of others, and be astonished at another's strength, and wish to possess it yourself. The stones rustle beneath our feet. We are ascending. With the years, armor-plated restraint covers your heart and all your skin. You do not hasten to question, and you do not hasten to answer. Your tongue has lost its flexible capacity for easy oscillation. Your eyes do not flash with gladness over good tidings, nor do they darken with grief. For you still have to verify whether that's how it is going to be. And you also have to work out what is gladness and what is grief. And now the rule of your life is this: do not rejoice when you have found. Do not weep when you have lost. Your soul, which formerly was dry, now ripens from suffering. And even if you haven't come to love your neighbors in the Christian sense, you are at least learning to love those close to you. Those close to you in spirit who surround you in slavery. And how many of us come to realize it is particularly in slavery that for the first time we have learned to recognize genuine friendship. And also those close to you in blood who surrounded you in your former life, who loved you while you played the tyrant over them. Here is a rewarding and inexhaustible direction for your thoughts. Reconsider all your previous life. Remember everything you did that was bad and shameful, and take thought. Can't you possibly correct it now? Yes, you have been imprisoned for nothing. You have nothing to repent of before the state and its laws. But before your own conscience? But in relation to other individuals? Refusal of metanoia means inevitable intermixture of earth and the underworld. Conscientious acceptance, by contrast, produces a characteristic transformation of personality, of action, imagination, and thought. Viktor Frankl states, "We who lived in concentration camps can remember the men who walked through the huts comforting others, giving away their last piece of bread. They may have been few in number, but they offer sufficient proof that everything can be taken from a man but one thing. The last of the human freedoms, to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's own way." And there were always choices to make. Every day, every hour, offered the opportunity to make a decision which determined whether you would or would not submit to those powers which threatened to rob you of your very self, your inner freedom, which determined whether or not you would become the plaything of circumstance, renouncing freedom and dignity to become molded into the form of the typical inmate. Alexander Solzhenitsyn echoes these sentiments almost precisely. And how can one explain that certain unstable people found faith right there in the camp, that they were strengthened by it, and that they survived uncorrupted? And many more, scattered about and unnoticed, came to their allotted turning point and made no mistake in their choice. Those who managed to see that things were not only bad for them, but even worse, even harder for their neighbors. And all those who, under the threat of a penalty zone and a new term of imprisonment, refused to become stoolies? How, in general, can one explain Grigory Ivanovich Grigoriev, a soil scientist? A scientist who volunteered for the People's Volunteer Corps in 1941, and the rest of the story is a familiar one. Taken prisoner near Vyazma, he spent his whole captivity in a German camp. And the subsequent story is also familiar. When he returned, he was arrested by us and given a tenor. I came to know him in winter, engaged in general work in Ekibistas. His forthrightness gleamed from his big, quiet eyes, some sort of unwavering forthrightness. This man was never able to bow in spirit, and he didn't bow in camp either, even though he worked only 2 of his 10 years in his own field of specialization and didn't receive food parcels from home for nearly the whole term. He was subjected on all sides to the camp philosophy, to the camp corruption of soul, but he was incapable of adopting it. In the Kemerovo camps, the security chief kept trying to recruit him as a stoolie. Grigoriev replied to him quite honestly and candidly, "I find it quite repulsive to talk to you. You will find many willing without me. You bastard, you'll crawl on all fours. I would be better hanging myself from the first branch." And so he was sent off to a penalty situation. He stood it for about half a year. And he made mistakes, which were even more unforgivable. When he was sent on an agricultural work party, he refused, as a soil scientist, to accept the post of brigadier offered him. He hoed and scythed with enthusiasm, and even more stupidly. In Ekibistas at the stone quarry, he refused to be a work checker, only because he would have had to pad the worksheets for the sloggers, for which later on, when they caught up with it, the eternally drunk free foreman would have to pay the penalty. But would he? And so he went to break rocks. His honesty was so monstrously unnatural that when he went out to process potatoes with the vegetable storeroom brigade, He did not steal any, though everyone else did. When he was in a good post in the privileged repair shop brigade at the pumping station equipment, he left simply because he refused to wash the socks of the free bachelor construction supervisor, Trivish. His fellow brigade members tried to persuade him. Come on now, isn't it all the same, the kind of work you do? But no, it turned out it was not all the same to him. How many times did he select the worst and hardest lot, just so as not to have to offend against his conscience? And he didn't. Not in the least. And I am a witness. And even more, because of the astounding influence on his body of his bright and spotless human spirit, though no one today believes in any such influence, no one understands it, the organism of Grigory Ivanovich, who is no longer young, close to 50, grew stronger in camp. His early rheumatism of the joints disappeared completely, and he became particularly healthy after the typhus from which he recovered. In winter, he went out in cotton sacks, making holes in them for his head and his arms, and he did not catch cold. The process of voluntary engagement in the revaluation of good and evil, consequent to recognition of personal insufficiency and suffering, is equivalent to adoption of identification with Horus, who, as the process that renews, exists as something superordinate to the morality of the past. This means that the capacity to reassess morality means identification with the figure that generates and renews the world, with the figure that mediates between order and chaos. It is within the domain of that figure that room for all aspects of the personality actually exist. As the demands placed on the individual who wishes to identify with the Savior are so high, so to speak, that every aspect of personality must become manifested, redeemed, and integrated into a functioning hierarchy. The revaluation of good and evil therefore allows for the creative reintegration of those aspects of personality and their secondary representations in imagination and idea, previously suppressed and stunted by immature moral ideation, including that represented by group affiliation, posited as the highest level of ethical attainment. The act of turning away from something anomalous is the process of labeling that anomalous thing as too terrifying to be encountered or considered in its most fundamental form. To avoid something is also to define it, and in a more general sense, to define oneself. To avoid is to say, that is too terrible, and that means too terrible for me. The impossibility of a task is necessarily determined in relationship to the abilities of the one faced with it. The act of turning away, therefore, means willful opposition to the process of adaptation, since nothing new can happen when everything new is avoided or suppressed. The act of facing an anomaly, by contrast, is the process of labeling that event as tolerable, and, simultaneously, the definition of oneself as the agent able to so tolerate. Adoption of such a stance means the possibility of further growth, since it is in contact with anomaly that new information is generated. This faith in oneself and the benevolence of the world manifests itself as the courage to risk everything in the pursuit of meaning. If the nature of the goal is shifted from desire for predictability to development of personality capable of facing chaos voluntarily, then the unknown, which can never be permanently banished, will no longer be associated with fear, and safety, paradoxically, will be permanently established. Solzhenitsyn concludes, it was granted me to carry away from my prison years on my bent back, which nearly broke beneath its load, this essential experience. How a human being becomes evil, and how good. In the intoxication of youthful successes, I had felt myself to be infallible, and I was, therefore, cruel. In the surfeit of power, I was a murderer and an oppressor. In my most evil moments, I was convinced that I was doing good, and I was well supplied with systematic arguments. And it was only when I lay there on rotting prison straw that I sensed within myself the first stirrings of good. Gradually, it was disclosed to me that the line separating good and evil passes not through states, nor between classes, nor between political parties either, but right through every human heart, and through all human hearts. This line shifts. Inside us, it oscillates with the years. And even within hearts overwhelmed by evil, one small bridgehead of good is retained. And even in the best of all hearts, there remains an uprooted small corner of evil. Since then, I have come to understand the truth of all the religions of the world. They struggle with the evil inside a human being, inside every human being. It is impossible to expel evil from the world in its entirety, but it is possible to constrict it within each person. And since that time, I have come to understand the falsehood of all the revolutions in history. They destroy only those carriers of evil contemporary with them, and also fail out of haste to discriminate the carriers of good as well. And they then take to themselves as their heritage the actual evil itself, magnified still more. The Nuremberg trials have to be regarded as one of the special achievements of the 20th century. They killed the very idea of evil, though they killed very few of the people who had been infected by it. Of course, Stalin deserves no credit here. He would have preferred to explain less and shoot more. And if, by the 21st century, humanity has not yet blown itself up and has not suffocated itself, perhaps it is this direction that will triumph. Yes, and if it does not triumph, then all humanity's history will have turned out to be an empty exercise in marking time, without the tiniest mite of meaning. Whither and to what end will we otherwise be moving? To beat the enemy over the head with a club? Even cavemen knew that. Know thyself. There is nothing that so aids and assists the awakening of omniscience within us as insistent thoughts about one's own transgressions, errors, mistakes. After the difficult cycles of such ponderings over many years, whenever I mentioned the heartlessness of our highest-ranking bureaucrats, the cruelty of our executioners, I remember myself in my captain's shoulder boards and the forward march of my battery through East Prussia, enshrouded in fire, and I say, so were we any better? Heroic adaptation. Voluntary reconstruction of the map of meaning. The group provides the protective structure, conditional meaning and behavioral pattern that enables the individual to cast off the dependence of childhood to make the transition from the maternal to the social patriarchal world. The group is not the individual, however. Psychological development that ceases with group identification, held up as the highest attainable good by every ideologue, severely constricts individual and social potential and dooms the group inevitably to sudden and catastrophic dissolution. Failure to transcend group identification is, in the final analysis, as pathological as failure to leave childhood. Movement from the group to the individual, like that from childhood to group, follows the archetypal transformative pattern of the heroic: paradise, breach, fall, redemption. Stability, incorporation, dissolution, reconstruction. Such transformation must be undertaken voluntarily through conscious exposure to the unknown, although it may be catalyzed by sufficiently unique or traumatic experience. Failure to initiate and/or successfully complete the process of secondary maturation heightens risk for intrapsychic and social decadence and consequent experiential chaos, depression, and anxiety, including suicidal ideation, or enhances tendency toward fanaticism and consequent intrapsychic and group aggression. The Bible, considered as a single story, presents this process of maturation in mythological terms. The Old Testament offers group identity codified by Moses as antidote for the fallen state of man. This antidote, while useful, is incomplete. Even Moses himself, a true ancestral hero, fails to reach the promised land. The New Testament, by contrast, offers identification with the hero as the means by which the fallen state and the problems of group identity might both be permanently transcended. The New Testament has been traditionally read as a description of a historical event which redeemed mankind once and for all. It might more reasonably be considered the description of a process that, if enacted, could bring about the establishment of peace on earth. The problem is, however, that this process cannot yet really be said to be consciously, that is, explicitly, understood. Furthermore, if actually undertaken, it is extremely frightening, particularly in the initial stages. In consequence, the imitation of Christ, or the central culture hero of other religious systems, tends to take the form of ritualistic worship, separated from other non-religious aspects of life. Voluntary participation in the heroic process, by contrast, which means courageous confrontation with the unknown, makes worship a matter of true identification. This means that the true believer rises above dogmatic adherence to realize the soul of the hero, to incarnate that soul in every aspect of his day-to-day life. This is easy to say, but very difficult to understand and to do. It is no easy matter to translate the transpersonal myth of the hero into a template for action and representation in the unique conditions that make up an individual life. It appears equally troublesome, even hubristic, to presume that the individual might be a force worthy of identification with the hero. Nonetheless, we are more than we seem, and are more trouble than we imagine when undisciplined and unrealized. The banality of evil, Hannah Arendt's famous phrase, applied to the oft unprepossessing Nazi personality, is, more accurately, the evil of banality. Our petty weaknesses accumulate and multiply and become the great evils of state. As our technological power expands, the danger we pose increases, and the consequences of our voluntary stupidity multiply. It is increasingly necessary that we set ourselves, not others, right, and that we learn explicitly what that means. The nature of the process of identification with the hero can be understood in great detail as a consequence of the analysis of alchemy, which Jung made his life's work. Alchemy, considered most generally as the precursor of modern chemistry, was in fact a 20 centuries long endeavor to understand the transformations of matter. The alchemical matter, however, was not the matter of modern science, logically enough, as the ancient alchemists practiced in the absence of the presumptions and tools of modern science. It was a substance more like Tao, that which produced or constituted the flux of being, something more like information in the modern sense, if information may be considered latent in unexplored places. Something more like the unknown as such. Something like the matrix of being. Investigation of this intrinsically compelling matter, this unknown, produced a series of internal transformations in the alchemical psyche, making it ever more akin to the philosopher's stone. Something that could turn base matter into spiritual gold. Something that had, in addition, the eternal, durable, and indestructible nature of stone. As the alchemical endeavor progressed through the Christian era, the stone became increasingly assimilated to Christ, the cornerstone rejected by the builders, the agent of voluntary transformation, whose actions eternally transform the fallen world into paradise. The late-stage alchemists posited that a personality that had completely assimilated the spirit of the unknown was equivalent to Christ. Jung translated their image-laden mythological language into something more comprehensible, but not yet understood. The terrible central message of this mode of thought is this: do not lie, particularly to yourself, or you will undermine the process that gives you the strength to bear the tragic world. In your weakness, the consequence of your lie, you will become cruel, arrogant, and vengeful. You will then serve as an unconscious emissary of the agent of destruction and work to bring about the end of life. The creative illness and the hero. I-N-R-I, Igni Natura Renovatur Integra, all nature is through fire renewed. According to John Dee, occult interpretation of the phrase I-N-R-I, satirically inscribed, as tradition has it, on Christ's cross. Iesus Nazarenes, Rex Ludeorum, Jesus the Nazarene, King of the Jews. The third mode of adaptation, alternative to decadence and fascism, is heroic. Heroism is comparatively rare because it requires voluntary sacrifice of group-fostered certainty and indefinite acceptance of consequent psychological chaos attendant upon re-exposure to the unknown. This is nonetheless the creative path, leading to new discovery or reconfiguration, comprising the living element of culture. The creative actor adopts the role of hero and places himself beyond, even in opposition to, the protective enclave of history. In consequence, he suffers re-exposure to the terrible unknown. Such re-exposure engenders mortal terror, but allows for union with possibility, allows for inspiration, reconstruction, and advancement. It is the disintegration and disinhibition of meaning preceding its reintegration, occurrences necessarily attendant upon the heroic process, that produce the phenomena linking genius in the popular imagination with insanity. The genius and the lunatic are separated, however, by their relative position with regard to the unknown. The genius is the fortunate hero who faces the unexpected consequences of his insufficiently adaptive behavior voluntarily, on ground that he has chosen. The unfortunate madman, by contrast, has run away from something carnivorous, something that thrives on neglect and grows larger, something that will finally devour him. The genius dissolves, is flooded with indeterminate meaning, and is then reconstituted, then dissolves, floods, and reconfigures the social world. The psychotic dissolves and drowns in the flood. It is capacity to voluntarily face the unknown and to reconfigure accordingly the propositions that guided past adaptation that constitutes the eternal spirit of man, the world-creating word. The existence and nature of that spirit has been granted due recognition in Western and Eastern philosophy and religion since time immemorial. The eminent theologist Reinhold Niebuhr states, In both Plato and Aristotle, mind is sharply distinguished from the body. It is the unifying and ordering principle, the organ of logos, which brings harmony into the life of the soul, as logos is the creative and forming principle of the world. Greek metaphysical presuppositions are naturally determinative for the doctrine of man. And since Parmenides, Greek philosophy had assumed an identity between being and reason on the one hand, and on the other presupposed that reason works upon some formless or unformed stuff which is never completely tractable. In the thought of Aristotle, matter is a remnant, the non-existent, in itself unknowable and alien to reason, that remains after the process of clarifying the thing into form and conception. This non-existent neither is nor is not. It is not yet. That is to say, it attains reality only insofar as it becomes the vehicle of some conceptual determination. The notion of the spirit's intrinsic kinship with the Creator was abstractly elaborated in much more detail in the eventual course of development of Judeo-Christian thought. From this viewpoint, man is understood most profoundly in terms of his relationship to God, as made in the image of God, rather than in light of his cognitive abilities or his place in nature. The essence of this spirit identified with God is the eternal capacity to create and to transform. Niebuhr observes that the human spirit has the special capacity of standing continually outside itself in terms of indefinite regression. The self knows the world insofar as it knows the world because it stands outside both itself and the world, which means that it cannot understand itself except as it is understood from beyond itself and the world. This capacity for infinite transcendence, which is the ability to abstract and then represent the abstraction, and then abstract from the representation, and so on, without end, does not come without a cost, as we have previously observed. We can tumble down the house of cards as easily as erect it. Furthermore, our capacity for evil is integrally linked with our ability to overcome boundaries. Abstract thinking in general, and abstract moral thinking in particular, is play. The game, what if? Games are played by first establishing, then identifying, then altering basic presuppositions. Before any game can be played, the rules have to be established. Before the game can be altered, the rules have to be made manifest. A game, at least in its final stages, is played by constructing an image of the world in imagination in accordance with certain presuppositions, which are the rules, the environment of the game, and then by acting in that imaginary world. This game construction, playing and modifying, is a form of practice for real-world activity. As games increase in complexity, in fact, it becomes increasingly difficult to distinguish them from real-world activity. The game itself, at its first stages, is played at the procedural level. The rules remain implicit. Once a representation of the game has been established, then the game can be shared. Later, the rules themselves can be altered. The child psychologist Jean Piaget discusses the formulation of the rules of children's games. From the point of view of the practice or application of rules, four successive stages can be distinguished. A first stage of a purely motor and individual character, during which the child handles the marbles at the dictation of his desires and motor habits. This leads to the formation of more or less ritualized schemas. But since play is still purely individual, one can only talk of motor rules and not of truly collective rules. The second may be called egocentric for the following reasons. This stage begins at the moment when the child receives from outside the example of codified rules, that is to say, sometime between the ages of 2 and 5. But though the child imitates this example, he continues to play either by himself without bothering to find playfellows, or with others, but without trying to win, and therefore without attempting to unify the different ways of playing. In other words, children of this stage, even when they are playing together, play each one on his own. Everyone can win at once, and without regard for any codification of rules. This dual character, combining imitation of others with a purely individual use of the examples received, we have designated by the term egocentrism. A third stage appears between 7 and 8, which we shall call the stage of incipient cooperation. Each player now tries to win, and all, therefore, begin to concern themselves with the question of mutual control and of unification of the rules. But while a certain agreement may be reached in the course of one game, ideas about the rules in general are still rather vague. In other words, children of 7 to 8, who belong to the same class at school and are therefore constantly playing with each other, give, when they are questioned separately, disparate and often entirely contradictory accounts of the rules observed in playing marbles. Finally, between the years of 11 and 12 appears a fourth stage, which is that of the codification of rules. Not only is every detail of procedure in the game fixed, but the actual code of rules to be observed is known to the whole society. There is remarkable concordance in the information given by children of 10 to 12 belonging to the same class at school when they are questioned on the rules of the game and their possible variations. If, now, we turn to the consciousness of rules, we shall find a progression that is even more elusive in detail, but no less clearly marked if taken on a big scale. We may express this by saying that the progression runs through three stages, of which the second begins during the egocentric stage and ends towards the middle of the stage of cooperation, 9 to 10, and of which the third covers the remainder of this cooperating stage and the whole of the stage marked by the codification of rules. During the first stage, rules are not yet coercive in character, either because they are purely motor, or else, at the beginning of the egocentric stage, because they are received, as it were, unconsciously and as interesting examples, rather than as obligatory realities. During the second stage, apogee of egocentric and first half of cooperating stage, rules are regarded as sacred and untouchable, emanating from adults, and lasting forever. Every suggested alteration strikes the child as a transgression. Finally, during the third stage, a rule is looked upon as a law due to mutual consent, which you must respect if you want to be loyal, but which it is permissible to alter on the condition of enlisting general opinion on your side. The correlation between the three stages in the development of the consciousness of rules and the four stages relating to their practical observance is, of course, only a statistical correlation and therefore very crude. But broadly speaking, the relation seems to us indisputable. The collective rule is at first something external to the individual and, consequently, sacred to him. Then, as he gradually makes it his own, it comes to that extent to be felt as the free product of mutual agreement and an autonomous conscience. And with regard to practical use, it is only natural that a mystical respect for laws should be accompanied by a rudimentary knowledge and application of their contents, while a rational and well-founded respect is accompanied by an effective application of each rule in detail. The second stage child, who accepts the presuppositions of his cultural subtradition as sacred and untouchable, thinks in a manner similar to the classic, partially hypothetical, pre-experimental or primitive man who worships the past in representation as absolute truth. The child and the primitive are both concerned primarily with how to behave, how to organize behavior contra nature in the social community to simultaneously and continuously meet ends deemed desirable. It is only much later, after these most fundamental of issues have been resolved, that the means of resolution themselves can be questioned. This act of higher-order conceptualization means emergence of ability to play games with the rules of games, and belief in the justifiability of such activity, this rebuff to traditional order. This more abstract ability allows for answer to the meta-problem of morality posed much earlier, not how to behave, but how can, or is, or was, how to behave be determined. Paradoxically, perhaps, the answer to this meta-problem also provides the final answer to the apparently less abstract question, how to behave, or what is the good? Some examples from Western religious tradition may aid in comprehending 1. The nature of the distinction between morality's central problem, what is the good, and meta-problem, how are the answers to the question, what is the good, determined? 2. The structure of their attendant resolutions. And 3. The manner in which the meta-problem and its solution follow in the course of historical development from the problem and its solution, attended by cyclical development of increasingly sophisticated and powerful self-consciousness. Let us begin with the problem of self-consciousness, which appears in part as enhanced ability of the declarative memory system to accurately encode the nature of human behavior, self and other. This encoding first takes the form of the narrative or myth, which, as stated previously, is semantic use of episodic representation of procedural wisdom. Semantic analysis of narrative, criticism, allows for derivation of abstracted moral principles. First order, pure semantic codification of the morality implicit in behavior and then in episodic, semantic, narrative, or mythic representation appears to take the form of the list. A list of laws, moral rules, straightforwardly and simply defines what constitutes acceptable behavior and what does not. An explicit list serves as an admirable guide for the adolescent emerging from the maternal world. Such a list might be regarded as the most basic form of explicit moral philosophy. The list emerges into the narrative of Judeo-Christian consciousness as a consequence of the actions of the figure of Moses, who serves as lawgiver for the Jewish people. Moses has many of the attributes of the typical mythical hero and constitutes a figure analogous to that of the supernatural ancestor of the primitive. He is characterized by endangered birth, for example, and by dual parentage, one set humble, one exalted or divine. And the king of Egypt spake to the Hebrew midwives, of which the name of the one was Shipra and the name of the other Puah. And he said, when ye do the office of a midwife to the Hebrew women, and see them upon the stools, if it be a son, then ye shall kill him, but if it be a daughter, then she shall live. But the midwives feared God, and did not as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the men children alive. And the king of Egypt called for the midwives, and said unto them, why have ye done this thing, and saved the men children alive? And the midwife said unto Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not as the Egyptian women, for they are lively, and are delivered, ere the midwives come in unto them. Therefore God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and waxed very mighty. And it came to pass, because the midwives feared God, that he made them houses. And Pharaoh charged all his people, saying, Every son that is born ye shall cast into the river, and every daughter ye shall save alive. And there went a man of the house of Levi, and took to wife a daughter of Levi. And the woman conceived and bare a son. And when she saw him, that he was a goodly child, she hid him 3 months. And when she could no longer hide him, she took for him an ark of bulrushes, and daubed it with slime and with pitch, and put the child therein, and she laid it in the flags by the river's brink. And his sister stood afar off to wit what would be done to him. And the daughter of Pharaoh came down to wash herself at the river, and her maidens walked along by the river's side. And when she saw the ark among the flags, she sent her maid to fetch it. And when she had opened it, she saw the child. And, behold, the babe wept. And she had compassion on him and said, This is one of the Hebrews' children. Then said his sister to Pharaoh's daughter, Shall I go and call to thee a nurse of the Hebrew women, that she may nurse the child for thee? And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, Go. And the maid went and called the child's mother. And Pharaoh's daughter said unto her, Take this child away and nurse it for me, and I will give thee wages. And the woman took the child and nursed it. And the child grew, and she brought him unto Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. And she called his name Moses, and she said, Because I drew him out of the water. Exodus 1:15-22, 2:1-10. After Moses reaches adulthood, he rejects his secondary Egyptian heritage and rejoins the Hebrews, in time becoming their leader and leading them away from Egypt and Egyptian servitude, from slavery under tyranny. He takes them on a heroic journey from the unbearable and fallen present condition through the purgatorial desert, where they act in accordance with procedures he establishes, to earthly paradise itself, the promised land of milk and honey. Northrop Frye comments, The biblical pattern for the purgatorial vision is the Exodus narrative, which is in three major parts. First is the sojourn in Egypt, the furnace of iron, a world visited by plagues, where the Egyptian desire to exterminate the Hebrews goes into reverse with the slaughter of the Egyptian firstborn sons. This episode concludes with the crossing of the Red Sea, the separation of Israel from Egypt, and the drowning of the Egyptian host. The second episode is the wandering in the wilderness, a labyrinthine period of lost direction, where one generation has to die off before a new one can enter the promised land. Psalm 95:11. This is one of several features indicating that we are in a world transcending history, and that it is in the more poetic language of the prophets that the true or symbolic meaning of Egypt, wilderness, and promised land emerges more clearly. The third stage is the entry into the promised land, where Moses, personifying the older generation, dies just outside it. In Christian typology, this means that the law, which Moses symbolizes, cannot redeem mankind. Only his successor Joshua, who bears the same name as Jesus, can invade and conquer Canaan. Moses is a revolutionary. He teaches his people a new mode of being. This means he revalues their goals as well as their means. This process of revolutionary readaptation is necessarily preceded by a period of intense suffering as the affects released by the new situation fight among themselves, so to speak, until subdued. The biblical story portrays this process dramatically, presenting it in terms of the lengthy and trying desert sojourn. The provision of heavenly food during this time is a hint to the meaning, so to speak, of the story, the interregnum of pain and confusion that precedes the reestablishment or improvement of stability can be tolerated only by those fed on spiritual bread, can be tolerated only by those who have incorporated sufficient meaning and have therefore developed wisdom, patience, and faith. In the course of the Exodus, Moses begins to serve as judge for his people. He is spontaneously chosen by them, perhaps on the basis of perceived strength or integration of character as mediator between conflicting claims of value. In this role, he is forced to determine what was right or what should be, and what was wrong or comparatively wrong. And it came to pass on the morrow that Moses sat to judge the people, and the people stood by Moses from the morning unto the evening. And when Moses' father-in-law saw all that he did to the people, he said, "What is this thing that thou doest to the people? Why sittest thou thyself alone, and all the people stand by thee from morning unto even?" And Moses said unto his father-in-law, "Because the people come unto me to inquire of God. When they have a matter, they come unto me, and I judge between one and another, and I do make them know the statutes of God and his laws." Exodus 18:13-16. Adoption of this responsibility entails voluntary acceptance of tremendous intrapsychic strain, strain associated with necessity of constant demanding moral judgment, establishment of hierarchical order, resultant of intrapsychic, quasi-Darwinian struggle of abstracted values, and, when the ability is there, consequent generation of compensatory adaptive activity. In the mythic case of Moses, such activity took the form of translation of moral principles from procedure and narrative representation thereof into an abstract semantic code. This act of translation constituted a tremendous leap forward, a qualitative shift in human cognition, regardless of whether it was actually undertaken by Moses or by any number of individuals over hundreds of years, a flash in time nonetheless from the evolutionary perspective, and conflated into a single event by the socially mediated process of mythological memory. The emergence of moral knowledge in explicit semantic form, as opposed to its implicit representation in narrative, appears represented in mythology as brought about by revelation. This revelation is reception of knowledge from a higher source, in this case, from the episodic to the semantic memory systems, from the mysterious domain of imagination to the concrete word. Generation, disinhibition, more accurately, of overwhelming affect will necessarily characterize transitions in cognitive ability of this magnitude, generation akin to that accompanying the insight phenomena typical of creative or psychotherapeutic endeavor. This might be considered a consequence of initial temporary establishment of intrapsychic integration, establishment of isomorphism or concordance between the procedural, episodic, and semantic memory systems, and recognition of the manifold possibilities, the hitherto unforeseen redemptive opportunities, thereby released. The first discovery of a new categorization system means immediate apprehension of the broad potential utility of those things newly comprehended, means understanding of the refreshed promise. This first discovery, eureka, is the positive aspect of the voluntary renovelization of experience. This process is dramatically represented in Exodus by the transformation of Moses' appearance as a consequence of his protracted encounter with God. "And he was there with the Lord 40 days and 40 nights. He did neither eat bread nor drink water. And he wrote upon the tables the words of the covenant, the 10 commandments. And it came to pass, when Moses came down from Mount Sinai with the 2 tables of testimony in Moses' hand, when he came down from the mount, that Moses wist not that the skin of his face shone while he talked with him. And when Aaron and all the children of Israel saw Moses, behold, the skin of his face shone, and they were afraid to come nigh him. And Moses called unto them, and Aaron and all the rulers of the congregation returned unto him, and Moses talked with them. And afterward all the children of Israel came nigh, and he gave them in commandment all that the Lord had spoken with him in Mount Sinai. Exodus 34:28-32. This shining face is mythic, semantic, episodic, equation of the individual with solar power, symbolic of illumination, enlightenment, momentary transfiguration into eternal representative of the gods. This great leap forward places Moses temporarily into the company of God. Moses transforms what had previously been custom, embedded in behavior, represented in myth, into an explicit semantic code. The Decalogue is the single most fundamental subset of the new code. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image, or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. Thou shalt not bow down thyself to them, nor serve them. For I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generation of them that hate me, and showing mercy unto thousands of them that love me and keep my commandments. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless that taketh his name in vain. Remember the Sabbath day, to keep it holy. 6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work. But the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. In it thou shalt not do any work, thou, nor thy son, nor thy daughter, thy manservant, nor thy maidservant, nor thy castle, nor thy stranger that is within thy gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that in them is, and rested the seventh day. Wherefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. Honor thy father and thy mother. Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's house. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, nor his manservant, nor his maidservant, nor his ox, nor his ass, nor anything that is thy neighbor's. Exodus 20:3-17.